Okay, Eric, are we ready for this? What's the sound of this? Anyone know what this is?
I'm ready.
Ready? What's that?
Sounds like a Red Bull.
That's a Red Bull. All right, now I can turn off for a little second here. While I think she has a Red Bull. And it's Friday. Bad combination. Excellent combination. You are listeners of the Nancy Skinner program. Or if you are, in fact, Nancy Skinner. She's had a busy day already. She still has one. We've got 3 hours of fun. And trouble. Crazy trouble today. It is the Nancy Skinner Show on Friday, 866-991-9927. The number to the program. Get Left coming up tomorrow, March 28th. The big Earth Hour. Everyone's going to turn the lights out on the planet. How cool is that? That's trouble. That's just like global trouble. In the galaxy, we're going to shut all the lights off. It's going to freak everyone out when the planet goes dark. Even as flooding devastates Minnesota and North Dakota. We'll be talking about that. We also have lots of news. We've got lots of economic news actually going on, of course, that we're going to get into. Fast money anchor Dylan Radigan makes a fast exit from CNBC. This caught my eye today. They had a spat. Lots of spats. I'm going to start with some spats going on. That's what I want. Is that okay, Eric? It's Friday. Can
yeah,
I start?
That works for me. You sound like you're in a fighting mood today.
I am. Got my Red Bull. I've been, you know, got to the gym today, so I'm fired up, pumped up. And there's just some really funny spats going on. Let's start with a few of those funny spats, and we'll get into serious, actually very serious spats. So this one, this anchor from CNBC, this is the host of Fast Money, and he quit. But here's the deal. He quit after he got into a fight with one of their business executives, Susan Krakauer. An insider is blaming the battle on that fight that they've had, a long brewing fight. I happen to actually know her. I've met her before. She's a lovely lady. So I think this has to be this guy's fault, Dylan Radigan. It was on the page six of the New York Post that says he's a highly volatile kind of guy. Oh, really? At CNBC. That's really shocking to me. So he's doing his show. I guess he also does the call and the closing bell. And he says, she sent him an email or something during a commercial break. Don't ask me to talk about every bleeping email that comes up on the screen. I'm not going to host a bleeping TV show that consists of reading bleeping emails to bleeping traders. He then accuses Krakauer of never addressing his concerns in private. You know what, Susan? I'm in the middle of hosting a show right now. So now is an unwelcome time to hear your voice. If you want to pull me off the show, please do, he roars. You are rude and disrespectful, and you lie to me routinely. Well, today's his last day as a host of Fast Money. Yeah, usually that's not a really good way to approach your boss. Do you think, Eric? I mean, I just think it seems a little, there are better ways to have a conversation.
I think you need to keep in mind bleep is a four, well, no, that's a five-letter word. So he's safe. It's okay.
Well, I was bleeping that. I don't think he said bleeping.
Oh,
you see what I'm saying?
This was a joke. And that's just for
You need liners. You need liners to say this is an Eric joke,
which means
it's not as funny as
a
standard joke would be.
It kind of misses something, and I have to explain it to everybody.
Got it. Yeah, that's a problem there. That is a problem in my business. Okay, here's the next fight. What did I call it? Spat, I want to get to. This is between Barney Frank and Antonin Scalia, Supreme Court Justice, using some heated words, at least from Barney Frank.
I do think this argument that it is unconstitutional for the federal government to pick and choose as to which marriages it will accept is a good one. At some point, that's going to have to go to the United States Supreme Court. I wouldn't want it to go to the United States Supreme Court now because that homophobe Antonin Scalia has got too many votes on this current court.
Well, here now to explain why he said that is Massachusetts Congressman Barney Frank. Congressman Frank, thanks for being with us this morning. A pretty pointed accusation there. What's the basis for that charge?
Two opinions written by Justice Scalia in which he makes it very clear that he thinks it's a terrible idea for people who are gay or lesbian to have equal rights. It's not based on his views on marriage. Obviously, there's a legitimate debate about marriage. A few years ago, the state of Texas tried to send to prison two men who had private consenting sex in their own bedroom. And the majority of the court said that's unconstitutional. That's an invasion of privacy. Justice Thomas said, well, I think it's a silly law. I would have voted against it, but I don't think the Constitution prohibits it. Justice Scalia wrote a long, angry dissent in which he made it very clear he thought it was a perfectly good law, and that, in fact, homosexuals, as he refers to us, are bad people, and the notion that there ought to be any kind of legal protections is a mistake. In an earlier case in Colorado, in which he again vigorously denounced the majority of the court for finding that it was unconstitutional to discriminate against people, again, not in marriage, but the basis of their political rights, he said, well, of course we disapprove of this. We often disapprove of things like murder. I mean, literally, when he was looking for comparisons to the public disapproval of homosexuality, the first thing he said was murder. So unlike many people who have different legitimate views on this, I urge people to read those two opinions in the Colorado case, the Romer case, and the Lawrence case. And again, there was just no question about his just absolute view that it is homosexuals are bad people and shouldn't be treated equally.
Okay, so Barney Frank calling Antonin Scalia a homophobe on CNN. I don't know if that, someone look the definition of homophobe up. I should do that, see if you believe that that's fair game, based on his opinions on these two cases where he equated homosexuality with murder. Yeah, that's not good. But homophobe, the origin would be a fear of homosexuals. This sounds like more like hatred of homosexuals, not fear of homosexuals. Although we know there's a fine line there, do we not? All right, speaking of sexuality, now let's move to heterosexual spats, because this happened too, and this is even weirder because it was during a markup of some budget legislation in Congress. Budget Committee Chairman Kent Conrad was on the receiving end of this one after telling a Senator Charles Grassley. Well, I'll let you hear it. It's Chuck Grassley of Iowa and Kent Conrad of North Dakota, who was on the program and at the center of the conservatives controversy, at a budget committee hearing talking about sex.
Is going to be a major item that we're dealing with. And I'd like to suggest to the chairman that he might want to support this, because you remember you asked me 2 years ago not to take a vote on it, and you said that if we did take a vote on it, you might not get your budget resolution adopted. And so I did not ask for a vote on it, and you said it was a very statesmanlike thing for me to do at that particular time. And so I would hope you would return the favor.
You know, and I used to like you. Let me just say, oh, you are good.
Well, your wife said the same thing.
She did. She said you were the biggest hit of all the speakers at the event.
Okay.
Let me just say this.
What is this about? This is at a budget committee. Your wife said the same thing, shoots back Charles Grassley, which let's hand him a sense of humor, but it does. The visual is not good there of Chuck Grassley and Kent Conrad's wife. I don't know what she looks like, but it's created a very uncomfortable visual for me.
I was picturing they were going to like exchange numbers and do a little swapping or something.
Yeah, it just seemed a little out of context. And then there was some carping from the crowd. So, and you could see Kent Conrad was trying to paper over that comment by saying, oh, yeah, you were very good at the dinner the other night. That's more than really we wanted. Mark the legislation up, will you? Get back to work. Give us a budget. Stop trading barbs. All right, when we come back, a real spat, a huge spat. Michelle Bachmann is fashioning herself as the new Margaret Thatcher here in America. Wait till you hear what she said. You want to hear her trying to pick a fight? Well, Michelle Bachmann from Minnesota, the congresswoman, she's at it big time. And we'll have some sound on that as well. But this one's for real. She's trying to ignite some flames. 866-991-9927. That's the number to the Nancy Skinner Program. It is Nancy Skinner. I am Nancy Skinner. I'm multitasking right now, just to, if you care, if you share. I'm just getting my, I'm going to be on Bulls and Bears tomorrow. The show, I know you hate to hear it, it's going to be on Fox News, but they're just giving me the last question we're going to deal with. I almost had a heart attack during the break. Let's see, here's the question. Let me send my thing. Should we let the auto industry die? That's going to be... Yeah, so let's see. And why not? Should we let it fail or not? And for me, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? So I had to send my response here. All right. So listen, you can watch me at 10 o'clock tomorrow. We're going to be talking about a couple of those topics later about the economy, but the auto industry, me on the auto industry. And they're all going to say, yeah, let it fail. I guarantee you of that. We will be armed and ready. All right. Before we move on to this Michelle Bachmann thing, this woman is just crazy, crazy. Jack in San Diego has a comment on Barney Frank, and then we're doing spats. We're doing weekend spats here. We're covering on Friday. Hi, Jack.
Well, hey, I'll be looking at Bulls and Bears tomorrow. I like that show, so I'll get to see what you look like. But I did have a comment on Barney.
You'll know that I'm the one that everyone disagrees with. That's how you'll know me.
Are you an economist too, or how did they pick you?
Well, you know, I've been doing those shows for years. I actually have a degree in finance. I know that Vicky doesn't want to hear this, but I have a degree in finance from the University of Michigan, and I've been a commentator on economic shows for about a decade.
Excellent.
So, and I'll be the one with the long blonde hair, lots of lip gloss.
All right, sounds good. Barney Frank. Well, you know, I like Barney Frank. He's an interesting character, but I was wondering, he was complaining about picking and choosing who was going to get married, but this is the same guy that doesn't fully understand the Constitution. I guess he doesn't know what a bill of attainder is, and he was willing to pick and choose who was going to be taxed at 90%, and taxing those bonuses, I believe, now is dead on arrival. I don't think Obama would sign that legislation.
Well, I don't think that the legislation is going to go through, but it's not going to be passed in the Senate.
Well, it's unconstitutional.
Well, I mean, that's for the Supreme Court to decide, is it? Isn't it? I mean, who's
well,
to say?
Well, if they're dumb enough to let it go that far, I mean, it's obvious.
You know, I mean, that whole argument, we could sit here and...
What a bill of attainder is?
Yeah, right, but that's like, there's another argument. That would be the argument for those to be made. The Solicitor General, if you were defending it, would say that if it's applied broadly enough... And you said that we are taxing profits that were obtained by taxpayer dollars on a broad category of people. I think that you could probably argue that and get away with it.
But Nancy, how could you even begin to do that when it was Congress that approved the provisions for the bonuses to be legal in the first place? Let's not forget.
Well, this is where I would move the discussion to, Jack, is that because we did not have the authority they now seek, which is the authority to regulate non-bank institutions, so then this never would have happened had they been able to go in when a non, like we do with banks, with the FDIC, if they're on the brink of insolvency, the FDIC can go in there and sort things out and pay the depositors, and if it's solvent, great, put it back on its feet or not. The same thing has to happen with non-bank institutions like insurance companies, like AIG. And had the president had this authority, there would have not been this situation.
But you know what? It was never the bailout of AIG was never voted on or approved by Congress. This was a bailout by the Federal Reserve System. The Federal Reserve bailed out AIG under its emergency authority.
There were two bills. There was the TARP, and then there was the stimulus legislation.
Yeah,
Congress did vote on that. That's what all the who
done. The initial bailout of AIG was done by the Federal Reserve.
That's correct.
It was never
$85 billion
on
September 16th. If you want to play names and facts with me, Jack, you're correct. It was Hank Paulson and Bernanke who met with AIG executives and Geithner when he was at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And on September 16th, the first $85 billion went to the door as a stabilization measure under the authority of the Federal Reserve. Then there was another bill that was passed by Congress for a broader TARP to cover other institutions that were on the brink of collapse. So you are correct, sir, in that. And we're never going to know whether it's constitutional or not because it's not going to happen. And today Obama, we'll get to this, he's meeting with bankers. And we're going to hear from Michelle Bachmann. She's calling for a revolution. That's the short order. A revolution, Michelle Bachmann is. All right, 866-991-9927 on the Nancy Skinner Show.
And Al Franken liked to say that, they offered when Congress wanted to abolish it, the Democrats offered them to lower it to $30 million, and the
raise the exemption to that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And the Republicans wouldn't even go for that.
Right.
And so that's how phony it is. But these ordinary people, they, you know, we're all John Galt or whatever. You know, all we got to do is, you know, kind of wake up 10-20% of these people.
Well, listen to this then. You're going to love this. Okay, Dave, sorry you're cutting out here, but you're going to love this, Dave. So you want to talk about stirring up a little class warfare, okay? How about this? This was Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann. She was on Sean Hannity's show yesterday, and she's talking about there was a minister in the UK who laid into Gordon Brown for deficit spending, and obviously they are a little bit more vociferous there, our friends across the pond, the Brits, than we are here. But anyway, so they play this as proof somehow that we are Marxists. And listen to her conversation, and then we'll digest it.
I don't know if you heard this comment, Mervyn King warning Gordon Brown to stop spending, and you remind me a little bit of what he has said. Listen to this.
Prime Minister, I see you've already mastered the essential craft of the European politician, namely the ability to say one thing in this chamber and a very different thing to your home electorate. The truth, Prime Minister, is that you have run out of our money. Every British child is born owing around £20,000. Servicing the interest on that debt is going to cost more than educating the child. As a consequence, under your captaincy, our hull is pressed deep into the waterline under the accumulated weight of your debt. You cannot carry on forever squeezing the productive bit of the economy in order to fund an unprecedented engorgement of the unproductive bit. You cannot spend your way out of recession or borrow your way out of debt. And when you repeat in that wooden and perfunctory way that our situation is better than others, that we're well placed to weather the storm, I have to tell you, you sound like a Brezhnev-era apparatchik giving the party line. You know, and we know, and you know that we know that it's nonsense.
Right? Is that amazing?
It is amazing. It couldn't be said more beautifully. Unfortunately, that is being replicated here in the United States under President Obama. We are headed down the lane of economic Marxism as more quickly, Sean, than anyone could have possibly imagined. It's difficult for us to even keep up with it day to day. I was stunned yesterday when President Obama said in the presence of the Australian Prime Minister that he wants the authority, as if they haven't done enough damage already with the economy. Now he wants to expand that authority so that he can go in and take over, essentially nationalize private companies if he so chooses, and then sets their wages. At this point, the American people, it's like Thomas Jefferson said, a revolution every now and then is a good thing. We are at the point, Sean, of revolution. And by that, what I mean, an orderly revolution, where the people of this country wake up and get up and make a decision that this is not going to happen on their watch. It won't be our children and grandchildren that are in debt. It is we who are in debt. We will be bankrupt in this country inside of 10 years if we don't get a grip, and we can't let the Democrats achieve their ends any longer.
Well, I'm inspired by what you're saying, Congresswoman, and I only hope that your fellow Republicans get as energetic and as outspoken as you.
Oh, great. That's all we need. Congresswoman Bachman, you have run out of ideas, would be my response. So Congresswoman Michelle Bachman is calling for a revolution now that we are headed down a Marxist track. She goes on, she talks about the global currency. She asked about that during the hearings the other day. Tim Geithner said no. President Obama was asked about it during his press conference. He said no. Yet she's launching a bill to outlaw any move toward a global currency. It's just stirring up stuff. I mean, they have nothing else to do. She goes on in this interview with Sean Hannity to say, right now I'm a member of Congress, not for long, and I believe that my job here is to be a foreign correspondent reporting from enemy lines. And people need to understand, this isn't a game. This isn't just a political talk show that's happening right now. Well, in fact, it was. You were on Sean Hannity's radio show. So really, it was just a political talk show. This is our very freedom. We have over 230 years, a continuous link of freedom that every generation has ceded to the next generation. This may be the time when that link breaks. And I'm going to do everything I can, I know you are, to make sure that we keep that link secure. We cannot allow that link to break because, as Reagan said, America is the last great hope of mankind. It goes on and on, in this whole thing. But are you kidding me? She's talking about, you know, calling for a revolution and calling the ability to regulate firms from ripping us off Marxism. When did that happen? So we should just continue to, you know, allow, as we have found out, these organizations like AIG, right? This is why we need this authority to, when they are on the brink of insolvency, we need this authority to be able to go in and say, okay, fine. If you are a systemic institution and you're going to bring down everyone else's 401ks and pension funds and the whole economy, because that's how intertwined we are now, with the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act and all the craziness and all the consolidation, if you are one of those institutions and we need to help you, then we're going to restructure you, which is exactly what they're doing with the auto industry. President Obama will be announcing his plans on Monday for that restructure. And that's what they're going to do. They didn't even need special authority. I'm thinking to myself about this. The auto industry, they just said, we're doing this. If you don't restructure and everyone take a haircut, two-thirds across the board, you're not getting your money. And I am kind of wondering, wait a minute. Now they're seeking authority to do that with non-bank institutions like insurance companies. We already just did it with the auto industry. What's the difference, really, there? Could we have gone in? Or do they just want to codify that authority? Because they just did it here to Detroit. And apparently, we'll find out on Monday, but it's pretty interesting. More on the Bachman as Margaret Thatcher coming up here. 866-991-9927, as well as your calls. So hang on the line right here on the Nancy Skinner Show.
You got me running, going out of my mind. Don't wait. Come on. Wait. Gotta hit the post. Don't bring me down.
Nancy Skinner's theme song when I'm on the air from 3 to 6. Don't bring me down. I got my Red Bull and my coffee today. Maybe that's the problem. Right there, 866-991-9927. Talk about bringing me down. The headline here says, Obama to discuss regulatory reform with bankers, the Reuters story. He's going to sit down with bankers and talk about regulatory reform and executive bonuses. And I'm thinking to myself, wow, I'd rather talk about the virtues of veganism with cattle ranchers, maybe, or I would rather discuss Zen-like centers with Ann Coulter.
Or how about my music selection?
Yeah, with Eric.
With me.
Or maybe you'd rather discuss the joys of heterosexuality with Larry Craig. That's, I don't know.
No, Nancy, I want to know from some of the people out there listening. You're dogging me on my musical choices, but what's everybody else think? Yeah, if they want to comment, I'd take their call.
All right.
Probably off the air.
Right, probably not. They probably could care less. Let's go to Los Angeles. They probably don't care about the music. Get to the issues. Stop laughing. Don't promote yourself and get to the issues. That's what we're going to do. Los Angeles, KTLK, Art is up first. Art is, you heard Congresswoman Bach, for a little bit longer. Bachwoman? Yeah, that's what we'll call her. Congresswoman Bachwoman. Hi, Art.
Hi, glad to be on the show. What she fails to realize, and Sean Hannity fails to realize, is we already had a revolution, and that was the November election. And they're out of luck.
Yeah, that was kind of a big one. Huge turnout, biggest win by any Democrat ever, mobilization. I think all told, it was on both sides, it was a couple $1 billion spent.
Yep.
And we actually voted in this guy and the whole Congress.
Absolutely.
So, she's a little, I gotta say, you gotta admit, she's the one who said that we gotta root out anti-American views, right, in Congress?
Yeah.
So, all right, Art.
She barely won.
Yeah. And she barely won, right? Because
yeah.
She had that a challenge as a result of having said that and barely won in a very conservative district. So,
right.
You know, she better, like I said, she better be lining up her radio talk. Maybe that's what she's doing. That's why she's on the Sean Hannity show, because she's waiting for the Michelle Bachmann show when she gets booted from Congress, would be my guess if you're doing your career management. 866-991-9927 to Huntington Beach now. Hi, John.
How you doing?
Great, thank you, sir.
Happy late birthday.
Hey, thank you.
Okay, my question is that during the Clinton administration, Clinton talked about getting health care for everybody. And he presented a card for universal health care. And my question is Obama keeps on talking about it. How is he going to do it without, raising taxes? How's everybody going to be – what this country needs is a nationalized system, okay? I mean, we have Medicare and Medicaid and Medi-Cal out here in California. But, some people don't qualify for that. But how's the government going to bring the health care costs down?
Well, what he said is, I don't know if we have those cuts, Eric, from yesterday from the town hall. If you want to pull those up, I can actually give you his wording. But what he said is this. Look, and this I agree with him on. When I ran against him, this was my position. You can't – if we had the ability to start from scratch, we could have gone to a system like the UK or Canada. But we can't, because most – it's an employer-based system. It's a result of FDR. I mean, there was wage controls, and health care was a fringe benefit, so it ended up being an employer-based system. 160 million people get their health insurance through their employers. So you can't take that many people and throw them into the government system who are happy with the private system. Politically, it's undoable. But you can take – the 47 million who don't have health insurance and offer them a health care insurance through Medicare, So that those people are covered. That brings all the costs down, John, because the problem is when people don't have any insurance, they wait till the last possible minute. They show up. It's the most expensive care there is, and everybody pays the price because that gets spread even to private insurers. So even if you have private health insurance, the reason your premiums are going up at double digits every single year is because you're paying for people who don't have health insurance. It's just idiotic. So what he's doing is he's making sure that we are covering everyone as in bringing them into the fold, taking the pool of risks. The larger the pool, the smaller the risk, the lower the cost is, and then also through technology and making all the records electronic. That's how.
Okay, exactly. I have a cousin. He lives down there in Australia, okay, and I used to listen to Hannity and Levin and how they used to degrade that system, you know, how people, you know, I used to, how they would say people from Canada are coming over here because the Canadian healthcare system's not that bad and everything. But, you know, I just want to make one thing straight. Okay. Like my cousin's wife works for the New South Wales Health Department, and they treat, if someone has a heart attack down there or in a real bad car accident, they treat people like they do here. Okay. The only thing is that is this, or artificial limbs, okay, because they don't have the doctors and they put you on a waiting list.
But you can't really, that's kind of apples and oranges, you know, that's arms and legs.
Yeah, but I'm saying, you know, like I said, I used to listen to Hannity and, you know, he'd get on the radio and say, oh, people are dying.
Of course.
You know, and Americans, you know.
That's why they did the Harry and Louise ads and everyone fought health care and that worked. I mean, it worked. This whole idea of talk radio and fear and manipulating people. That's why Harry and Louise, those ads, government-run health care, it actually worked. And that's why I think we've learned a lot from that episode. And as we go back into it, we can't let the Michelle Bachmans of the world, who toss words around like Marxism when we're seeking regulatory control, some sanity, scare us. That's the short order of it. All right. Coming up, boy, I've got some more. The floods are happening like crazy up north, right? And we have people who don't want to do anything about climate change. Are you kidding me? We're going to be dealing with that right here on the Nancy Skinner Show. Nancy's going to show, which is usually a pretty good day here. No boy toy. James Boyce is not here. Self-describes himself that way. It's not sexist when you choose to describe yourself as a boy toy.
What about me?
I would not. Boy toy? That would not be a word for Eric. It's all man. Boy toy. It's a different category. All right, so I want to get into this because this is a topic. It's kind of dear to my heart. Vicky, if you're listening, you know, I'm just going to warn you. I'm going to involve at least a little bit of my experience in dealing with this topic, in this subject, in this segment. So just this is a warning to Vicky that I could perhaps involve myself in this because I was involved in this. Watching carefully the flooding that is has begun, really, along the Red River, reaching record levels, flooding Fargo and Minnesota as well, it bordering. The Red River rose to, it's 40 feet early this Friday. I don't have a TV here in my studio, but it's breaking a 112-year-old record. They've never seen anything like it before. Well, they have, actually, back in 1997. Not quite as high, but really high, because I was there back then. I think it was like 37 feet, and completely flooded this whole area out. The 100-year floodplain thing happens every few years, and for those folks, as we are going to be talking about coming up here, the Earth Hour, which is tomorrow, where the whole Earth at 8:30, whatever time zone you're in, people are going to turn out their lights as a tribute to, as a message to the planet that we have to deal with climate change and global warming. And if this is an irony for you folks, that, you know, I just I'm going to be talking to a guy from Ayn Rand who thinks it's a bad message to send. As we see these floods continuing, this is something I've worked on. I'll share that experience with you and with Vicki about the work I did on these flood communities. And one thing I learned is that this is a direct result. The extreme weather is a direct result of climate change. And the 100-year floodplain rules that were set up are ridiculous because they're breached on a regular basis. And that is a result of increased precipitation in the atmosphere due to global warming. So even as we've been talking about the conservative Dems in Congress, who are now saying that they have to throw global warming overboard because we have more urgent things to deal with. We can't do cap and trade right now because we have a global economic meltdown. They are, I think, reality, as in floods, don't really care about what their timetables are. It continues unabated and must be dealt with. To be sure, it's not about the next election cycle when it comes to global warming, should I say. I think someone who might agree with that sentiment is Liz Butler. She is the field and outreach director for One Sky, which is a conglomeration of many types of environmental groups have come together in an organized effort to send a clear message, actually get some progress done on global warming. And Liz is with us now. Hi, Liz.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Are you associated with Lori David's group? Is this a part of it, or are you a different group?
We're a collaborative climate campaign that has about 350 allied organizations that was brought together a little over a year ago. That's multi-sectoral and across different lenses on climate. So it's not part of Lori David's group, but we have a number of organizations that are engaged in the One Sky campaign. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's good. I mean, you need them. I mean, they're yeah. You're all working for the same common purpose.
Yeah.
All right, so here's the thing. When things like the floods happen to me, it seems to me these are the opportunities to connect the dots for the American public because they're just not connected by the mainstream media. I was involved in the floods of 1993 with the Missouri River and helped rebuild these communities as models of environmental sustainability. It was, I'll tell that story in a little bit, but we went in with a team of architects and engineers and moved them off the floodplain, rebuilt them with all the best technology you could, got a presidential award for it, wrote a policy report about how to green the disaster policies for each agencies. It was adopted by Hazel O'Leary at the PCSD. Nothing ever happened. So here we go again. These lessons, these climatic extremes don't seem to galvanize the community or the politicians to make the connection between that and global warming. Do you agree or disagree, first of all?
Well, I would say that they often on a community level, if you talk to average folks in New Orleans about what their thoughts on global warming and Katrina, like there is a pretty high understanding of the link between some of these complete extreme circumstances in global warming. Policymakers, you're right. They would rather not deal with this issue right now, and that's one of the reasons that we were formed is to really focus on mobilizing the public pressure that exists around global warming. I have a 7-year-old. You ask my 7-year-old and any of his school friends about global warming, they know. They understand what causes it. They understand the outcomes. They understand it in a very broad brush way.
Can they contribute to campaigns?
Well, you know, if you've ever seen a little kid ask a politician a question, you better believe that when they put them on the spot, politicians respond. However, because of the fact that the oil industry and the coal industry and the fossil fuel industry has historically given a lot of money to Congress and put a lot of pressure on different politicians is one of the reasons that we haven't seen action. in the United States, especially over the last 8 years, frankly. But we're still seeing that Congress isn't moving on this issue, which is why our analysis is that we have to turn the public support into public action to actually hold their policymakers accountable and tell them what we need done and that we need it done right now.
Okay, so how do you do that?
Well, how we do that is like in next week, starting next week, we have hundreds of citizens and coalition partners actually going to meet with their legislators during the April recess. The expectation is that there's going to be lobby visits across the country in all 50 states with our members of both the House and the Senate telling them that we need action on climate, we need bold action on climate, and we need it now. We don't just need it from an environmental lens. We need it to fix our economy, and we need it to put people back to work, and we need it to wean ourselves off of fossil fuels. And so it's calling for green jobs and legislation that actually caps carbon and then invests in renewables and energy efficiency, which is the way to actually get people working in a lot of communities.
Well, okay, so we've tried that. I mean, I think that message is, in my honest view of this is, because I've been on the front lines of this topic for a very long time, Liz, is that I think people get that. I really do. I think that at first it was just when Rush Limbaugh and all those guys were calling us environmentalist wackos, saying it wasn't real, and you had that well-funded effort by the oil industry to confuse the public about it. I think we kind of got past that. It took well over a decade to get past that. And like you said, the young people, the millennials we talked about on my show yesterday, this group of people that helped really tip this election, they get it.
Yep. It's not about the public not getting it.
No, it's not.
It's about the politicians.
Yeah.
Which is why instead of our focus being like, hey, go home and change your light bulb, our focus is, hey, get your neighbors together and go meet with your member of Congress and tell him that he actually has to vote the right way on climate or he's going to hear about it in the next election cycle.
Now you're talking. So you guys actually are trying to get people to commit to
meeting with their members.
When do they go into recess?
They go into recess next week. They're in recess for 2 weeks. It's basically the 3rd of April until about the 19th. And so we have a national call out, One Sky, and then a bunch of our allies, including the Energy Action Coalition, that just brought 12,000 youth to D.C. to have a huge conference called Power Shift and then have over half of them hit the Hill on Monday. Biggest lobby day on climate that have ever happened in U.S. history. There was 6,000 young people on the Hill telling members of Congress, we had a huge impact on this last election cycle, and we're here to tell you that our top issue is climate, and we want you to do something.
Hey, Liz, if you know what I want to do is tell people, because I think a lot of people are intimidated about go visit a member of Congress or who's home. Will you stay with us, and we'll just walk people through the steps, how easy this is, right?
Yeah.
And we'll teach them how to freak with their heads.
Yeah.
Because it's really not that hard to do. I mean, you saw Michelle Bachmann. These people are just people. Come on. And here's your chance. They're home for 2 weeks. Just, wouldn't that be cool? If you've never done anything, if you sit there and listen to talk radio and agree with me all the time, here's your chance to really have an impact, because just showing up and making an appointment, and Liz Butler will walk us through at One Sky how to do that. Let's empower yourself. You'll feel good. So we're going to show you how to do that. 866-991-9927. And talk a little bit about the Earth Hour. We're going to shut off the lights for an hour. Wow. Everyone's freaked out about that. What would one do? 866-991-9927. The number to the Nancy Skinner Show. Without the worries of quick to this society, for Mr. Windows a bum. His only worries are sickness and an occasional harassment by the police in their chase. Jump right back in here on Friday in the Nancy Skinner Show with Nancy Skinner, 866-991-9927, and Liz Butler, who is the Field and Outreach Director for One Sky, trying to do something about global warming from many angles. And before the break, Liz, she's saying, hey, listen, folks, the public gets this.
the flooding is happening, green jobs, we all voted for green jobs, we have this huge mandate, we want those jobs. There's a market-based approach called cap and trade that even businesses want to get behind at this point.
Yeah.
You know, the only thing is you've got a couple of recalcitrant members of Congress, and I would say on both sides of the aisle, unfortunately, now. So, it doesn't matter. So you guys, your job is to tip them over. They're in recess for the next 2 weeks. They recess next week from the 3rd to the 19th. And, Liz, I was saying to a lot of people who agree with me, because I know this, there's a difference between you listen to, watch these shows on MSNBC and listen to people like me and you say, yeah, I agree, and then you vote that way. But you can step it up a little bit by going to visit your member of Congress, even a senator. They have office hours and you have the ability to do that. So why don't you just tell people, how does one, let's say, okay, I'm going to really do this. This is important to me. I want to be part of making sure this happens. What's step one, two, and three?
Well, the first step I would say is to go to the One Sky website, which is onesky.org, and sign up for the Congressional Lobby Visit push. The reason I suggest that people do that is that we're doing training calls, and we have how-to guides and kits, and we can literally spoon-feed give them everything,
okay,
from a letter on down. But the basic thing is, the first thing you have to do is figure out who your member of Congress is. A lot of people don't necessarily know. There's a good website called Congress Merge that you can actually go research a little bit about your member of Congress. But most of the time you can Google it, you can call your city hall, they'll be able to tell you who your actual member of Congress is or who your senator is. You call their district office, and they all have district offices, and you say that you want to talk to the scheduler,
mm-hmm,
and that you want to set up a meeting during district recess. And the key things to stress is that you're a constituent. The way that politicians work is, they have to care about two things, money and votes, in order to keep their job.
Right.
So they do care about people in their community, and they do care about when people want to meet with them. Now, I would say that if you happen to be a small business owner or you happen to be a member of a church or any other organized group in your district,
mm-hmm,
you want to bring that up when you talk to the scheduler, because often, even if you're just going as an individual, you're somewhat representative of what other people in your community are thinking, because they're not going to. Because, like you said, a lot of people just don't go meet with their member of Congress.
Right, but they can. They don't realize they have the ability to do that. You call their scheduler and you say, "Look, I'm in a business, or you can even say,
yeah,
I work for some large company and I'm a constituent, and I know you have some office hours, and I'd like to schedule a few minutes, right?" And they will,
yep,
they'll get you in.
Yep, and a lot of times it's a really good idea to follow up after talking to the scheduler with a short request in writing, so that they have it both by fax and by phone call. And then from there, it's just as simple as finding out a little bit of information and going in and actually doing the meeting. I would say that if for some reason the scheduler feels like there isn't space, you can drop by the office. People do it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you may not actually get to talk directly to the member during that time period, but you will end up getting to talk to
your member. Will know you were there because their,
yeah,
staff will tell them,
exactly,
people are dropping by the office. That will create pressure under any, whether you actually make it in, okay, or not.
Yeah.
In the interest of time. So you get in, all of a sudden you're sitting down with a senator or a member of Congress, and you can go to your onesky.org. You guys did a good job of summarizing the basics so that people, you just have that working knowledge,
yep,
of the what aspect, the green jobs, the energy, the climate, whatever,
yep,
it is, national security. What do you want them to say?
We basically want them to tell the members of Congress that we need to pass a bill that actually deals with global warming and creates a green economy, that actually creates caps on global warming pollution and invests in renewables and not fossil fuels.
Right, so they can just say basically, I support this cap and trade plan that the president supports. Are you voting for it? I would tell them to ask that question. Don't just say what you think. Say to that member, are you voting for it? Or,
yeah,
are you blocking it? Because I need to know that, because I'm going to go out and write my neighbors if, based on your answer.
And I would say the other thing that people need to remember is they are not there as an expert. They do not need to go in and know everything about a bill. It is enough as a constituent to say, I'm concerned about this issue, and I want to know that you will support a strong bill.
Right. And then ask them, yes or no. Ask that question, yes. Liz. I'll add that to your lobbying
totally right.
efforts.
You want to get a
yes or no.
Yes or no.
And make them squeam if it's no. Okay. Hey, I'm out of time. People can go to onesky.org, get all the tools they need, and then I'll have them report back to see if they actually, what their experiences were with members of Congress and what the answer was. Thanks a lot, Liz Butler. Appreciate
it. Thanks a lot.
Okay, onesky.org, man. You want to lobby? Lobby? This is lobbying on crack. It is the Nancy Skinner Show. All right, it is the Nancy Skinner Show on a Friday. I'm Nancy Skinner, 866-991-9927. I'm going to tell you why activism is so important, okay? I'm watching the news reports about the record river levels in Fargo. They have broken a 112-year record. They're threatening the dikes, fortifying the city. The mayor pledged to go down swinging. The guy who headed up the Katrina effort, it starts with an H, I can't remember his name. He's out there, and he's saying, hey, these sandbags are not going to save your life. You need to evacuate. They have told people it's not mandatory. It's a directed evacuation. The point being, it's the worst that the 112-year record. They say we've never seen this, so we don't know what to expect. Well, they did see it back in 1997 when the town was flooded. I'm trying to find the details on this. I was there in this time because I had a little experience earlier. And here's the important we shared with them our experience in 1993 of record floods and dealing with that disaster, and the team that I was with was brought up to consult in the same region, and they ended up rebuilding in the same area. This happens a lot. This has been happening. It's been an endless pattern of rebuilding in the 100-year floodplain, but it's not a 100-year floodplain anymore. It gets routinely flooded out. That's the issue. So just to show you a little bit, and Vicki, this is a segment I'm just warning you about, a little bit about what activism can do. There's a book called Eco Pioneers, Practical Visionaries Solving Today's Environmental Problems by Steve Lerner. I'll just read from his book. I won't put it in my own story, my own account. But here's a chapter called New Pattonsburg, Missouri. It's a selected accounts here. Moving out of the floodplain and designing an environmentally sustainable community. When the rains first started in earnest in June 1993, everybody in Pattonsburg, Missouri began to keep an eye on the river. The Grand River jumped its banks, but that was not all that unusual. The water had escaped the river before without flooding the town. But by July, the residents, like the people in hundreds of other communities up and down the Missouri and Mississippi rivers, were fighting to keep the water out of their homes. It goes on and on to say this. We all watched this. If you remember the great Midwestern floods back in 1993, it was one of the first, I think, visual episodes of seeing it because these houses were getting washed down the river. Remember that house, that one picture of the house going down the river? And it was just horrifying. They're talking about billions of dollars of damage. It just destroyed endless, countless towns. You know, people were deciding whether to get out of town or to evacuate or not. It goes through the sort of the story of how it was all building up. And let's see. Next page. They get completely inundated yet again. These people have rebuilt their homes. Many call them river rats. They keep rebuilding every time at the federal government expense, I must say. FEMA has always paid for a lot of the rebuilding efforts. And the Corps of Army Engineers just says we'll build the dikes and we'll build all the protection levees better next time. Never fails that it fails. Says while the flood was having its way with the residents of Pattonsburg, Missouri, Nancy Skinner was warm and dry in her apartment in Chicago watching television coverage of massive Midwestern flooding. At the same time, Skinner was a 30-year-old self-employed entrepreneur and environmentalist who sold environmentally safe paints free of VOCs, volatile organic compounds. As the extent of the flood devastation unfolded, Skinner had an idea. Since the government was poised to spend $6 billion on flood relief in the Midwest, why not use the funds to relocate communities out of the flood zone so that in the future, federal dollars would not be needed to bail them out again? And why not rebuild those communities on higher ground using the best available environmental technologies and energy-efficient practices so that the new communities will become models of sustainable development in the Midwest? These were reasonable questions, but for most people, this kind of brilliant idea about how things ought to be would have faded within an hour. Skinner, however, is a persistent woman whose bouts of enthusiasm have staying power. You can say that. It's been 20 years. Needing somebody to bounce the idea off of, she called her father, who heard her out, and then said, with more than a trace of sarcasm, "Great idea, Nancy. What are you going to do? Call the White House?" In fact, that is exactly what she did. She telephoned Washington the next day. Over the following week, she ran up an impressive phone bill calling the EPA, FEMA, the Department of Interior, Department of Energy, Small Business Administration, the White House Office of Environmental Policy, a host of other bureaucracies. Her suggestion that flood relief funds be used to rebuild communities along more energy-efficient and environmentally sound lines was generally received as a good idea. But the federal employees she spoke with just pushed her along the line to some other bureaucrat who might be interested. Skinner's telephone marathon continued without rest until she spoke with Bill Becker at the Department of Energy, who had unique experience that permitted him to appreciate the potential of Skinner's suggestion. As the former editor of the Kickapoo Scout, a newspaper in Soldiers Grove, Wisconsin, he had been instrumental in lobbying to see his town moved out of the flood zone to higher ground. They had had the same experience in 1978. A flood destroyed Soldiers Grove. And when Bill Becker was a newspaper editor in this town, he had a similar idea. They passed the first solar ordinance in the country requiring that newly constructed commercial buildings derive at least half of their heating from the sun. And Bill Becker was a spearhead of this idea. So I'm getting bounced, if you're following the story, and I was just not going to let it go. Why are we, on the one hand, this is the Clinton administration, we have all these lofty environmental goals, and you're going to spend all these billions of dollars rebuilding these towns. Why not spend it on the best technology to commercialize that technology to get people to understand that we can do better, that there is advancement? Anyways, so I finally get... As the story goes, I feel like the Princess Bride. I'm reading from a book about my life. So I finally get the call. Is like, okay, now you got to call this guy Bill Becker at the Department of Energy. Fine, I'll do it. I did. The story continues. When Skinner and Becker connected over the phone, two of the pieces fell into place that were needed to convince federal officials to use disaster relief as an opportunity to rebuild communities using an ecologically sustainable design. Skinner served the function of a gadfly, willing to pester the federal bureaucracy into action, while Becker was a federal official with personal experience in the Midwestern floodplain. What they needed was someone who could pull together specialists from around the nation who knew how to design and build environmentally friendly and energy-efficient community. Becker knew just the man for the job. Bob Birkebeil, prominent Kansas City architect who was spurred into his interest in ecologically intelligent architecture as a result of a tragedy. You see, Bob Birkebeil was the lead architect on the Hyatt Hotel in Kansas City where a skywalk collapsed, killing dozens of people. When it did, he sped to the hotel and joined efforts to rescue survivors from the rubble. For the next year and a half, he was engaged in litigation over responsibility for the tragedy. While he was ultimately exonerated, the experience left a scar. In the wake of that collapse, Birkebeil began to rethink the buildings he had ever designed. He went back to his drawings to see in greater detail how they were put together. In the process, he learned a lot about where building materials come from, what they're made of, what toxins they contain, and what energy is required to manufacture and transport them. So it kind of goes through his own process about the need to, that we can do much better in terms of the energy requirements, and he ended up taking a leadership role at the American Institute of Architects, the AIA's Committee on the Environment. He headed up that. So Bill Becker and I called Bob Birkebeil and put together the dream team of architects, Pliny Fisk, Bob Birkebeil, all the architects and engineers who had been writing the books on the best possible technology, passive solar homes, the best building materials that use these homes are so well designed. You don't need HVAC systems at all because of the passive solar nature of them and the construction, the building materials, to that extent, water reutilization, all these things. So we put together, because I can't read the whole thing, we put together a dream team of architects and engineers, went into two of these towns. I'm calling this little mayor in Valmire, Illinois, who's underwater, saying, hey, mayor, have you ever heard of sustainable development? He tells this joke frequently now because we went on to do this. We had conferences. We went into two towns, Valmire, Illinois, and Pattonsburg, Missouri, with our team of architects, worked with the people who had been flooded out, convinced them to move off the floodplain. The joke is, after my month marathon of phone calls, I was at the White House, okay, after Bill Becker and I connected and we talked. These agencies are 14 federal agencies sitting around the table listening to me, just a citizen at this time. I had no authority. I was just a citizen who kept calling saying, why aren't we doing this? And they said, you know what? That's a great idea. My dad said to call the White House. That's when we proceeded to put the dream team together. The funding was already in place. It would have been through FEMA anyways. We just directed it in a more sustainable way, worked with residents. Over a two-year period, we rebuilt these communities, incorporating as much technology as we possibly could. Went back, so a couple years later then, received a presidential award from President Clinton's Council on Sustainable Development, delivered by Al Gore, who personally, I had read his book Earth in the Balance in 1992, and that's why I said I wanted to use my business degree to help advance alternative energy. That's why I decided not to go to Wall Street, but to promote alternative energy, because I believed global warming would be the biggest threat to humanity, and I could actually do something about it because I had the finance and business background that was crucially needed. So this is all outlined in the story, and as I review this, this is 1993, and look at the pictures of what we did here, what we were able to accomplish. And the reason I share that story with you is because you don't have to be some big head of some organization or scientist or anything to make a difference. I just believed I had this idea, and I just didn't stop. I was able to help this thing. Now, listen, I went on to write a report called The Greening of Federal Disaster Relief Policy. And we looked at every agency and how they could all change their policies. So this doesn't happen again. So it's an automatic thing. It just never. We submitted the policy report to Hazel O'Leary, that at that time the head of the Department of Energy. Do you think the Bush administration adopted that? Do you think the whole bureaucracy really moved and did it? No, they didn't. And so it's disturbing to me. We were called up. Our team was called up to the same area in North Dakota. In Minnesota, the Red River, and they were flooded out. They didn't do a fraction of what we did in terms of incorporating these technologies. And they're right back at it. They rebuild exactly where they are, and now they're looking at record flooding. And the federal government never adopted that. That's why when President Obama says, we're talking about making structural change and real change and fundamentally changing the way bureaucracy works so that we're using our dollars wisely, he's... You know, you ain't kidding. It's hard to change a bureaucracy. But what we did, we built a couple of towns. We educated people. Some books were written. So if you can't spend like an hour to go lobby your member of Congress over the next week when they're home or 2 weeks, take 10 minutes out of your time to schedule that appointment and then go see them and just say, I care about this issue. You know, that's how it happens. I was no one special. Look at where I am now. Just kept happening to me. All right, enough of that. The stories. Sorry, Vicki, you can listen to the show again. I'll stop with the personal stories, but it's near and dear to my heart. That's why I share it with you, to see the same flooding about to happen and all the reports of people saying, we've never seen this, oh my goodness, and there's no connection to global warming. Of course there is. Of course there is. It's just going to get worse and worse. We have to do something about it. All right, it's Friday, Eric. Lighten up. 866-991-9927. That's the number to the program. I'm done with my story on the Nancy Skinner Show.
All right. Here you go. So I end up from those marathon phone calls. Here I am on the radio, still talking about global warming. See, that was 93 or 2000. That's been a long time. And we're on the very verge of actually doing something about global warming. The political battle has been so tough. The public education battle. 866-991-9927. First of all, I'm going to say, who's going to actually take up that challenge and have the guts and nerve to go talk to a congressman? It's really not that hard because they're not that intimidating once you really meet a lot of them people in person. I'll tell you that. But here's what I want to talk about, because you know this is going to be big, because tomorrow we won't be on the air with you tomorrow. But March 28th is the Earth Hour. Okay, already Rush Limbaugh and others are railing against this. Wow, that's surprising. You know, I talked about it with my honey bunny and Sweet Pea and said, listen, now I think you should get behind this.
Dimitri, this is a joke.
Love bucket. Buckets. Love bubbles. You need to get behind this. He assured me he would. Are you going to?
No, I was just going to say, Dimitri, the joke is over now because you're back talking serious stuff.
Oh, okay. All right. It's the Earth Hour. And what it is every across the globe, everyone's turning off their lights at 8:30 p.m., no matter what time zone you are in. So let me see. So far, they have 2,848 cities and towns in 83 countries across seven continents prepared to unite for Earth Hour. Oh, you can just tell Rush would be all, of course he'd be all over this. 829 icons and landmarks around the world to switch off lights in support of climate change action. So we have 66 national capitals, 9 of the 10 most populated metropolises. What is the plural of metropolis? On the planet have confirmed their participation in this event, along with some of the world's most promising cities. New York, London, Beijing, Paris, Moscow, Singapore, Berlin, Rome, Athens, Cairo, Washington, D.C. Ha! It should go dark in Washington, D.C. Rio de Janeiro, Dubai, Mexico City, Sydney, Mumbai, Toronto, Copenhagen, Manila, Istanbul, Nairobi, Bangkok, Los Angeles, L.A. You listening, KTLK? Barcelona, Hong Kong, Buenos Aires, Cape Town, and Kuala Lumpur. I mean, and that's just a little list. I didn't see Detroit on the list. We'll have to work on that. And they're going to also, here's the thing. This is how big this is. You have the Great Pyramids of Giza, the world's greatest symbol of power of collective action, will be shut off, and 829 other landmarks, including the Eiffel Tower, dark. Bird's Nest Stadium in Beijing, dark. In fact, they've already practiced. The Chinese are practicing to turn the lights off. They have a better education over there. A lot of engineers. Christ the Redeemer in Rio. Big Ben in London. Empire State Building in New York. Dark. Acropolis in Athens. Dark. Colosseum in Rome. Dark. Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco. Dark. So don't drive on it tomorrow at 8:30. Arc de Triomphe in Paris. Dark. Sydney Opera House. Las Vegas Strip. Dark. CN Tower in Toronto, I've been there. That's scary. Dark. Niagara Falls, Wembley Stadium, Sears Tower in Chicago. Dark. Symphony of Lights in Hong Kong. Dome of St. Peter in Rome. Edinburgh Castle. This is huge. I don't think anything like this on a global level has ever happened before. Tomorrow at 8:30. So, what say you? What do you get? That's what I want to know. We're going to talk about what are you going to do to fill the darkness, the void, the hour? 866-991-9927. That coming up next on the Nancy Skinner Show.
Fingers, I'll be jeweled with diamonds and gold.
causing trouble for longer than I actually realized, technically. So there you know. That's how it all got started, actually. Ended up continuing my work on global warming. I just read a story about how I helped with these flood communities, which is freaking me out because I'm seeing it happen all over again in Fargo, North Dakota. I was very involved in trying to change policy for good and forever back in 1993 era. And we had temporary progress, but it really went back to the way things were. And we don't make progress. So this is our window to do it. And we were talking about this. Now, this is, you know, Rush Limbaugh, my little lollipop. he is out. He's out on against this Earth Hour thing. Oh gosh, can you see Michelle Bachman or what's her name, Bachman? She's worried about Marxism, and here the whole world tomorrow night at 8:30 is going to sit in the dark in as a response as a symbol what are their words? It's a call to action on climate change. Only hours away, something like 3,000 cities, the world's all their monuments will go dark, of course, at 8:30 in each of their time zones, all over the world. And this is China, the governments of China and India. So for all these naysayers who keep putting off progress because they say that China and India aren't participating, they are leading the way. They've issued proclamations that they want to be part of the solution. Rush Limbaugh and his gang is out there, this group called Carbon Sense, is saying, okay, Rush Limbaugh called it Dark Hour, said it's the stupidest thing I've ever heard of. And Carbon Sense is saying, this group that, it's probably just some fossil fuel group, oh, what do you notice, is saying that people should spend that whole hour sitting in the dark with no transport, air conditioning, or hot coffee, remembering the contribution that carbon fuels have made to modern society. And while contemplating this hour of darkness, they should steel themselves for the hour when, if the global warming alarmists have their way, this will become a necessity, not a nicety. Get used to it. We're going to ruin your life because we're out using solar and wind as opposed to fossil fuels. The last gasp. All right, let's go to Portland, Oregon and get Patrick into this conversation. Hi, Patrick.
How you doing, Nancy?
I'm very well, thank you, sir.
Good, love your show. I like you. You're not a narcissist. So Vicky had it wrong yesterday, too.
Well, that's nice to hear. Did you hear that, Mom? I'm not really a narcissist. Eric will tell you. Well, I don't know what Eric would say, actually.
Yeah, you're real cool. You're like Rachel Maddow. She's real cool when she's on TV, and you're real cool on the radio, unlike whom I won't name in this time slot before you, just reminded me of a female Jack Nicholson, just out there and just crazy. I had to turn the radio off sometimes because she was just going off on people so much. I'm like, yeah.
We all have different styles, you know. I know all the hosts, know a lot of them on my side certainly, and everyone has just a little different temperament, a little different style. So it's like you know, what flavor do you like, Patrick? That's kind of how I see radio. But what do you think of this? What do you see of the Earth Hour? I mean, I'm surprised. Actually, it was on the front page of the Detroit Free Press, but I was surprised that it didn't get more press, that it didn't come to my attention sooner, given my inclination. I tried to get someone from the international organization to come on the show today, but we just couldn't pull it off. Would you consider, and I'm going to put this out there for folks, 866-991-9927. Now you've heard it. Do you think it's somehow one world regime if you sit in the dark? Like, you know, they actually suggest the activities. People are going to have friends and family over for dinners, candlelit dinner, take your dog for a walk in the park. There's a whole list of share a romantic night with your loved one. I mean, there could be a population boom. That could be a one side effect. Will you do it, Patrick? Will you take an hour out of your life and not have lights on?
Well, I don't think I'm going to sit around with no lights on. I've got a bunch of compact lures and bulbs in my house and LED lights. I think I'm doing my part there. So, but sitting in the dark, no, I'm kind
of... For one hour, just to make a statement? Because there's a larger principle involved about making that statement?
How about this? I usually leave the lights on the outside of my house on all night. I'll leave them off tonight.
Well, you know what? You should do that. I mean, one of the things that drives me nuts is when I see big office buildings and nobody's in them, and every floor. See, this is what a big part of what Obama's talking about. It's not just taxing pollution. We have to rebuild our standards here. And when you technically can't turn off floors of lights in major office buildings that are being unused and the whole building is lit, it's just a complete waste of energy that costs money and pollutes the atmosphere with more carbon that threatens our future. Turning the lights out is not the worst thing. This is the thing that bothers me, though, Patrick, that this kind of event, here, I'll tell you, I have some mixed feelings about this. I was thinking about this morning on the treadmill. You will have, when you talk about being in the dark, people say, see, you're a Luddite. You want to go back to that day and just turn the lights out and turn your thermometer down like Jimmy Carter with his little cardigan. And that's not what modern environmentalists are talking about. They're talking about really speeding up technological change so that you just don't use fossil fuels. You use a different type of energy generation. It's about advancement. It's about breakthroughs, thresholds. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I agree. Like here in Portland, I get the impression sometimes that they view the car as the enemy. I'm like, no, the car isn't the enemy. The fuel is the enemy. We need a cleaner fuel.
Correct. Absolutely. Yeah, it's not the car. I'm from Detroit. Are you kidding me? I ran for Congress on the platform of global warming in the home of the auto industry. So this girl has some. Patrick, thanks for calling. Appreciate your call.
Thank you.
Okay, Portland is a very environmentally friendly city. It's like one of the best. They actually have green spaces. Oh, my God, talk about communism. So I'm for it. Eric, you won't sit in the dark for an hour? You won't light some candles? Isn't that romantic?
I'm single, so it's that romance.
How about a hot bubble bath with a bunch of candles? I often do that.
I prefer a hot bubble bath with a very attractive woman.
Well, you know what?
Candles would work.
You got like 24 hours, dude.
Well, I'm going to start looking as soon as I get out of here. Hey, you know what? Can I throw something else out?
Sure.
Just because you're not a narcissist, I'm going to throw this out. Tomorrow, you're on Bulls and Bears, aren't you?
I am. I am on Bulls and Bears. I have someone else doing my promotion now. That's great. Yes, on the Fox News Channel, you can see me actually on Bulls and Bears at 10 a.m. Eastern.
Be able to see your golden locks?
No, you can see that without my little headsets on that ruin my hair and fighting of usually three or four conservatives on issues of what's our topics. I already know them. They got them to me. Oh, there's been some improvement in the economy because consumer confidence numbers went up a little bit. And they're saying, well, that means we don't have to pass all Obama's plans because Consumer Confidence University of Michigan survey, the U of M survey, try to get that guy on too today, ticked up a little bit. And guess what?
Guess what
I figured out? Well, okay, they're saying so now that it's ticked up, we don't have to enact those because we're starting to come out of it. Well, the survey, if you look at the details, he said the reason consumer confidence went up is because people feel better that Obama's plans are going to pass and help them. Which I thought was so funny. So now people are already starting to feel better because we've elected a president that has plans that aren't the plans of the last group. So they're saying, okay, we believe in this guy. We think he's going to fix the economy. Our confidence has risen. And so those same folks are using that uptick, as small as it is, in consumer confidence to say, so let's cancel that. Let's not do that.
So you're basically the argumentative whipping boy for the
No, show. there's no whipping boy in me.
Wow.
Are you kidding me?
That's what they lure you in
thinking.
So people listen
you watch
to the show,
for yourself.
If they happen to tune in, they're not going to see you getting walked all over.
I don't think it's ever happened. But
I don't think so either.
No.
This is a joke to me,
Trish. And you know what? Even if you've never turned on Fox, it's just great viewing to see me give it to them. So, you know, I promise you... You can change the channel if you want. You're not going to get stuck. 10 o'clock. And the other question is, should we just let the automakers fail? Are you kidding? You're talking about getting me going on that topic? So anyways, tune in tomorrow at 10 o'clock on the Fox News channel. And enough of that narcissism. I'm out. Coming up, someone who thinks the Earth Hour is bad. So bad. Can't wait to hear this on the Nancy Skinner Show. Now, all right, so this whole idea of the whole Earth getting together and doing something in common, like for a greater purpose, you would think that not everyone would say, that's great, peace on Earth, let there be peace on Earth. Believe it or not, there are some people who think that this could be not a good thing for the planet, that it actually could be sending the wrong signal. Reading a piece this morning called The Real Meaning of Earth Hour by Dr. Keith Lockich, who is a fellow at the Ayn Rand Institute, a PhD, focuses on science and environmentalism, wrote a piece calling he's actually saying that the Earth Hour is essentially sending the absolute wrong message to the Earth. So we had Dr. Lockich join me today to explain. Now, all right, so this whole idea of the whole Earth getting together and doing something in common, like for a greater purpose, you would think that not everyone would say, that's great, peace on Earth, let there be peace on Earth. Believe it or not, there are some people who think that this could be not a good thing for the planet, that it actually could be sending the wrong signal. Reading a piece this morning called The Real Meaning of Earth Hour by Dr. Keith Lockich, who is a fellow at the Ayn Rand Institute, a PhD, focuses on science and environmentalism, wrote a piece calling the real, he's actually saying that the Earth Hour is essentially sending the absolute wrong message to the Earth. So we had Dr. Lockich join me today to explain how it is that the whole Earth coming together to try to send a message about energy and our use of resources and preserving them could possibly be sending the wrong message, and he's with us this morning. Dr. Lockich, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. I think the problem I have with Earth Hour is I think it sends a false message. I think if the entire world came together for a positive cause, I think that would be great, but I don't think this cause is positive, and I think the message Earth Hour sends is false and deceptive. It's basically Earth Hour, you know, tries to make it seem as though giving up fossil fuel energy will be easy, will be painless, will even be fun. You know, people treat it like a big party. It's an event that's been going on for a couple of years now. At last year's event, you know, people went stargazing, they held candlelit dinners. It's not a big deal to turn off the lights for 1 hour when you know that all the life-saving benefits of industrial civilization are just a light switch away. And what I claim is that this sort of party carnival atmosphere bears no relation to what it would actually be like to give up fossil fuel energy to the degree that we're being called for by proponents of environmentalism.
But I think the key component that you're missing here is that we're not talking about giving up energy. We're talking about giving up fossil fuel-based energy. We're
right,
talking about moving to solar, hydrogen, wind, and not like overnight, but that it doesn't this send, Keith, a message that the world is behind alternatives. Just like, let me give you an example. When we had the problem with CFCs, we had a Montreal protocol. The whole world came together and said, you know what, CFCs are causing the ozone hole to widen.
Well,
and we found an alternative, and that's an issue that's been solved.
Well, I think there are questions about the science behind that also, but we don't need to go into that.
My point is that the world came, they found an alternative, they moved.
Of America's electricity comes from burning coal. Now, I think it's a myth that we're going to make up that, and I mean, let alone, you know, plan for continued growth. Green movement and green philosophy is really all about. And you see this in the fact that as soon as any kind of large scale, industrial scale alternative, oppose them, just this week we have Dianne Feinstein, you know, promising that she's going to submit legislation blocking the development of solar energy. Philosophy is about finding solutions and solving problems and finding new ways of producing energy. I know that that's what a lot of people think, and a lot of well-meaning people think that, but I think if you look at the actual meaning of what environmentalism is all about, it's really about opposing energy.
No, you know what? That's really not true. I mean, I've been in the environmental movement for many, many years now. Too many more than I want to admit, Keith. But what about cap and trade? Now, this should be for you at the Ayn Rand Institute perfect. You are using market forces, market mechanisms to innovate, to find solutions, to advance technology.
I'll say that a government-enforced cap on carbon emissions has absolutely nothing to do with the free market. If you want entrepreneurs on a free market to you know, invest in research and development for solar and wind. And if somebody can find a way, I mean, I'm not opposed to alternative energies in the sense that, you know, if there's some technological breakthrough that makes them feasible.
But when you put the forces of profit motivation in front of people, and that's what you guys are all about, is individualism and ideas, you put that out there, that tantalizing prospect, and we will find those solutions.
Yeah, but so why did, but those forces are already there. Why does the government need to do that? That's my objection.
Well, they're not, but they're not there. That's the problem. They aren't there because the market doesn't have the national security needs of reducing our carbon footprint and our dependence on foreign oil. The market that's where the market fails.
Well, see, that's the thing. I reject the whole concept of market failure. I think that, so the claim that these sort of government incentives represent some kind of market solution is a myth. What this really is, it's a government-imposed program. It's driving me crazy. One more time.
Okay, folks, a little bit of housekeeping here for you. I want to remind you that I will be on Bulls and Bears tomorrow on the Fox News channel. That's 10 a.m. Eastern time. And I, trust me, not pulling any punches, as usual, will be on tomorrow morning. So I want you to tune in and see that, and we'll talk about it on Monday. And I have to leave a little early today. I'm going to be right up front with you. I have lost a dear friend, a former state legislator here in Michigan, State Senator Aldo Vagnosi. For all the discussion we've had about politicians, and so many people say that they're all bad, and the public service, anyone who gets in there, they're all about themselves and the lobbyists. You are so wrong when you meet someone like Aldo Vagnosi. Aldo started running for office late in life, got creamed his first election, kept going, knocking on door after door after door. I think he's knocked on 20,000 doors in his career. By the end of his term limited time in the Michigan legislature, he had 80% approval ratings. And you know what? Aldo always did the right thing. He followed his progressive convictions wherever it led him. And the consequences be damned. And you know what? It served him. He was untouchable in terms of his political behavior. So for me, he was a personal hero. He stood with me in my run for office for Congress here. He was at every event. I took the time out to get the farm team going. And even when I ran again and the party wanted someone else, Aldo said, no, the right thing to do is to stand with her. She came within 3 points of winning, and he did. And there are not many people like that in politics anymore. I grant you, there are a handful. But they're there. They are out there. Unfortunately, we have lost one of our finest in Aldo Vagnosi. So I'm going to his memorial service. A lot of people asked me about the Jane Hampshire interview that I did yesterday, Fire Dog Lake, if they could hear it again. I missed it, darn it. So I was talking with Jane Hampshire of Fire Dog Lake about the conservadems and their effort to hold the Obama budget hostage. So she's leading the effort to hold their feet to the fire, which is what we really need to do in this time period. And a lot of people asked to hear that again and see how they could get involved, because just having elected this president apparently does not mean his agenda will be enacted. There is more work to do. So if ever we needed to hear from Jane Hampshire and what she's doing at trying to keep these guys accountable, accountabilitynowpack.com is the website for this. Now is the time. I started off by asking Jane about the website Fire Dog Lake, which is so huge, and how she got started.
Well, back in 2004, when I first started it, I was actually just blogging as a hobby on Daily Coast. And, you know, I tried to see if I could get my diaries up on the recommended list and get people to read them. But once they fell off, that was sort of it. So I just started saving them for my family and friends over on a little Blogspot website. And when they asked me what the URL should be, I didn't really know what a URL was. So I used my loan out company, which was, if you have a loan out company in Hollywood, which is where my background is, every corporate name has been used. So you wind up with things like, you know, Mutant Enemy, Joss Whedon's. So I just put Fire Dog Lake because I like to lie by the fire with the dogs and watch the Lakers. and not knowing that I would have to, like, live with the name 5 years later. So
and get asked this question every time.
I get asked
this question
all the time. Mm-hmm. Where does the name come from? So that was sort of how I got the name, but I never expected it to be anything other than just, you know, a little hobby. And the next thing I know, we were just covering the Scooter Libby trial, and 100,000 people a day were showing up, and so I have to tell that story a lot.
So that's, you're really getting hit like 100,000 times a day?
Oh, yeah, easily.
Yeah, so you need serious server space for that.
We do.
Major operation.
We do. We have serious server space. We get hit with denial of service. We've been through all those trials, but we've got a pretty good system now.
Well, that's great. And you promote. See, I got in trouble for promoting myself. I'm like, wait a minute. That's how we start to. You get out there. You go on TV. You put your name on your website. Then you talk about it. It's all in the name of trying to get you what it is you're doing out there. Your product. In this case, for me, it's the ideas I believe in, and progressive causes. Mine was global warming. Is how I got started in all of politics back, and I was one of the first hosts back in 97 on radio, because that was my issue, global warming. That was my issue. I pulled out some old tapes, like, here I am in 98 going, this is going to be a huge problem. Anyways, we've come a long way. And so and now I find myself back on the radio during a really interesting time, because we've taken power. The White House, the president, great, wonderful, historic president, has taken power. But it happens at the time of a global economic meltdown that they've left with us. So we got a couple of hot things going on today. I've been following the whole economic crisis quite closely, the Geithner hearings. Probably you and I are of a very small group of people who are riveted by the House Subcommittee Financial Services hearings on the technical.
Fascinated. I got to wake up every morning and watch the House Financial Services Committee hearings. That sort of drives my day.
All right,
my exciting life.
Yeah, that's how I feel too. So you blogged today. You posted about the Geithner's. He's testifying before this. Is that the Senate? House?
House Financial Services.
House Financial.
He's testifying today about the need for regulation, but he also talked about his new private public insurance.
Yeah, and we've been talking about that. I followed the hearings the other day. Today I was watching the town hall. But what's the news there today? It's to me, in terms of framing this, I had Jeffrey Feldman on, and we were talking about framing it. If they're asking for additional authority to regulate non-bank institutions as well as sweeping regulatory authority so that it doesn't happen again, so the SEC has to register these private equity funds, or they have to be registered with the SEC, I should say. Mm-hmm. So to me, it seems like that should be an easy sell to the public, because it's like we wouldn't have had the AIG bonus mess had we had this authority. But now the Republicans and everybody, they're going to say big government, communism, centralized planning. What do you think? How do you think Geithner's doing a good job selling this?
Well, I think this plan calls for them to be able to regulate AIG like they would have regulated a bank, but I don't think that they ever tried to deal with the problems of executive compensation. So I don't think that this particular, what they're asking for right now, the regulatory powers, would have address that. And I think that that's a problem. That's a much larger problem, because we learned during the SNL scandal that insolvent SNLs had a similar pattern where executives would come in and they would milk the company. They would give loans out that were very questionable to, say, you know, the Alt-A or subprime loans, because that was where they could get the highest fees.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would push that money out to the executives in the form of compensation, bonuses, everything else. So, you know, there's a whole, Bill Black, who writes about white-collar crime a lot, calls it a system of perverse incentives.
Well, so you're saying it has to be part and parcel. If you're going to have a regulatory scheme, there has to be some, because this is the funneling of money, essentially.
Right. And Bill says that, you know, what you need is to tie bonuses to long-term performance, because you can cook the books and do all kinds of accounting funny stuff to make it look like you have short-term performance and tie bonuses to that. But it doesn't actually accrue to the benefit of the company, the long-term health of the company, or to the stockholders.
Hmm. Now, didn't they hint at that, the hearing the other day, both Bernanke and Geithner? I thought they kept saying two clear lessons. One is we've got to stop it. I think the question of, here's what it was. The executive compensation, they talked about having standards or regulation. And he said pretty much standards, which I interpreted as voluntary. And anything that is voluntary to me is sketchy and is not going to be followed by those who don't want to.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the problem, that nothing they have proposed has real teeth. I mean, so far their proposals have been vague, so you can't say, you know, you can't pick them apart and say, well, you know, this is bad or this is good. But to the extent that we know what it is, it does raise some questions as to whether it would be effective.
All right. So I'm sure that obviously this is going to be get drawn out as time goes on. The other thing I'm really steamed about is the fact that the president essentially has to deal with his own party first before we get to the other side.
There is the Evan Bayh problem. And I think that is part of a larger problem. The two problems are connected.
How so?
Well, remember the K Street Project?
The lobbying effort, the organized, right, you can't do business with this government unless you donate to our party. The
there
effort
you go.
Led by, who was his name? Tom DeLay, I believe, was
Tom
the
DeLay, Jack
mastermind.
Abramoff.
Right, uh-huh.
He wanted to be able to suck up all the lobbying money, funnel it to the people in the party, and be able to exert the influence that accrues from having lots of campaign donations. It makes it easy to get reelected, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So when we voted for change in November, we thought we were getting, you know, hope and, you know, a new vision for America and being saved from the kleptocrats. But there was a whole group of Democrats who thought, we can have that money now, right? We control what gets passed. We would really like to see that money flying into our coffers. So it doesn't take too much Googling to see a bunch of articles on the Hill or the other, D.C.-centric papers where they talk about how all this lobbying money is now flowing into the pockets of the Blue Dogs or the New Democrat Coalition or the Conservatives. And the close relationship between these people. And you can see it in articles. Ellen Tauscher, when she was trying to kill the cram-down bill, was saying, you know, was bragging that all the New Democrats were from Wall Street and that they were working closely with the banks. And I think Evan Bayh is now trying to kill the cram-down bill in the Senate, and he's bragging that he's working closely with the bank lobby. So, you know...
Okay, this is really, really disturbing to me on many levels because... of the cap, you know, we're this close to cap and trade and health care, and that our own party could sabotage it, Jane, is very distressed. Let's put it that way. It's just very distressing. Can you come back and tell us what the community, what the online community can do and what other people can do to thwart this from happening?
Will do.
Okay, great. Jane Hampshire is with us from FireDogLake.com. How cool is that? This is so much fun for me. I got some sound from Jean Shaheen. She was on Rachel Maddow's show last night, part of this Blue Dog group, literally threatening to not do health care and energy, playing a huge game of chicken with President Obama on this. We don't even need enemies. And the logic just doesn't flow. Wait till you hear some of the sound on the other side. 866-991-9927, the number to the Nancy Skinner Program.
Priorities for the budget. I think we need to invest in education and health care and move towards energy independence. We need to reduce the budget deficit. We're all about trying to make sure that we can do that. I worked to try and get the Economic Recovery and Reinvestment Act passed in a way that was able to bring along some Republican senators to get that done, and that's what I am intending to do in the Senate.
That's Senator Jean Shaheen of New Hampshire, I believe, former governor of New Hampshire, saying we're all about Obama's priorities for health care, for energy, for everything else he stands for, but we're not going to pass it, actually. We're all about it. We're for him, but we're not going to take the easy step with our Democratic majority to actually execute. You hear what I'm saying here? Jean Hampshire is with me from FireDogLake.com. And they're called the Conservadems. Rachel Maddow used that term last night. I don't know if that was already previously coined or who gets credit. I like it. Whoever said it, Jean, what do we do here? I mean, this is essentially your own party. As Obama has said so many times, look, this is now. He has a 63% approval rating. He's got to do all these things because they're investments in the future, and he's got to do them now. So if these guys you're saying are looking at their bankrolling for their next election, and that's, you know, partly a factor, I'll be kind, then what do we do about it, the people who work so hard on electing this Democratic president and Congress?
Well, number one, you need to look at the heart of the problem. I mean, Evan Bayh, who is going to be involved in, you know, trying to keep health care from passing, is someone whose top donors are Goldman Sachs. He took $123,000 between 2003 and 2008. Eli Lilly and Company, he took $66,000 from. He took altogether over $1 million from securities and investment firms and $241,000 from insurance companies. His wife sits on the board on 8 different corporate boards and makes about $835,000 a year from that. And one of those
I'm going to spit more coffee out. $800,000 from sitting on the board of directors?
One of those she sits on the board is WellPoint. I think she gets about $350,000 a year for that. And Evan Bayh helped WellPoint secure a grant for $24.7 million. For them. She's also on the board of E-Trade.
I am sure there's absolutely no connection there.
And Evan Bayh is on the Senate Finance Committee. So no conflict of interest there. And so when you're sitting there and you're looking at the fact that Indiana has a huge foreclosure crisis, and Evan Bayh is trying to stop cramdown, which would allow bankruptcy judges to cut foreclosures by about 20% with absolutely no cost to the taxpayers, just by being able to write down these mortgages to what their true value is.
And cap and trade. Gene Shaheen said that the states with geography issues, carbon intensive states like Michigan and others, we can't essentially do that. I want to know who's bankrolling them, because the cap and trade is the way to go. I don't know how you feel about it.
Absolutely. You're sitting here and people are talking about these people like they're centrist or conservative Dems. They're not. They're corporatists. They're not representing their district. They're representing the lobbyists who are paying them. And when that information gets out there, people stop looking like sensible moderates, which is what they're trying to paint themselves as.
Mm-hmm.
And people who are making a naked—you start seeing them as people making a naked power grab, because they're bragging that they can join with the Republicans or the Democrats to pass legislation. Right.
So, and here's where to completely expose them as having no clothes. They have the opportunity right now with budget reconciliation process to avoid a filibuster and just pass this stuff. Boom, tomorrow it could be passed because of the numbers of the votes that we have right now. And they don't want to do that. And they don't have a good excuse for why they won't want to do it.
They came out preemptively against President Obama and said that they were going to keep keep this from happening, because they have some high-minded principle to the filibuster in the Senate, that they were going to join with the Republicans and do this.
Okay. So what's the answer?
The answer is, number one, start referring them to who as what they are. Number two, if you live in...
What term do you use?
I use corporatist.
Corporatist, okay.
Or obstructionist, but mostly corporatist. I mean, Evan Bayh lives in a state that Obama won.
Name these people quick. Wait, 1 minute. It's Evan Bayh. It's
Evan Bayh, Pryor, Blanche Lincoln, Gene Shaheen, Kay Hagan, Bill Nelson, Ben Nelson... there's a whole list.
Okay, so they can go to your website, I'm sure. You can go to firedoglake.com and you'll figure out who these people are. Let's know them. Let's write them. Let's call them.
Write letters to the editor in your local papers.
Saying this is the time. We voted for energy. We voted for healthcare.
We voted for change. We didn't vote for WellPoint.
For change in your pocket. Jane Hampshire, so cool that you're with me. I really appreciate that.
Thanks so much.
Okay, we'll be reading. Jane Hampshire, firedoglake.com. Isn't that maddening, folks? I got some more sound from her coming up from Gene Shaheen. It's like babbling what the answers to these questions. Like, why don't you just do this? Wait till you hear the sound. It's pretty good stuff. You're on the Nancy Skinner Show.